You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
I'm Mike O'Hanlon, and it's my pleasure to welcome you all here to talk about a country that everyone here on stage loves dearly, and I know you do too. And we're all very concerned about the future of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And we're talking today about its ongoing crisis in security and politics and everything else, frankly, which follow from those high-level security and political challenges. I'm joined by a remarkably accomplished and credible cast of characters on this subject, people who have lived in Congo or, who, in the case of Nita, are from Congo. All of us on stage have spent a lot of time there, have really developed a strong bond with the country and are very concerned about where it is today. To my immediate right is Anthony Gambino, who is the head of the Ponzi Foundation USA, which works originally on health issues and women's issues in eastern Congo and has broadened to other kinds of NGO work and civil society strengthening in that region and elsewhere in the country. Next to him is Nita Evele, who runs Congo Global Action, which is a consortium of a lot of groups concerned about the future of the DRC. She's from Kinshasa and visited most recently last fall. And then next to her is Dane Erickson, who's the director of the Eastern Congo Initiative, a group that's now been around about 7 years and focuses on conflict and related issues in eastern Congo. And he's just been visiting the region himself in recent weeks and will return soon as well. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the DRC when it was still called Zaire, so that's my street cred, but I haven't been back since 1984. So mostly I'm just honored to be part of this discussion and still very concerned about the country and looking forward to learning. What we'd like to do this morning is essentially have two rounds of discussion up here, Q&A, on where things stand in DRC today and what we should do about it. And when I say we, I'm talking about everyone, Congolese, Americans, other foreign actors, and then we want to bring in your comments and questions in the second half for audience Q&A. I think, let me just say a brief, broader word about framing and understanding the broad contours of the issue, and then that's sort of what our first round of questions will do as well, is to situate you all, for some of you who may not be specialists, or in any event, whether you are or not, I think it's important to get a strong factual foundation of where we are at this point in the Joseph Kabila presidency and in the evolution of DRC, which has now been around, I guess, for 56 years, I think. And therefore, I think always of the magazine Jeune Afrique, DRC is not so young anymore, but it still has amazing opportunity and potential. It's one of the great countries of Africa, one of the largest, one of the most well-endowed, both in terms of its people and its natural resources, but of course continues to be a country that struggles. We know the antecedents for this go back to the colonial days, in a period in which the Congolese people were not well treated and not well prepared for independence, struggled through early years of independence in the context of a Cold War competition that also magnified and exacerbated problems there in the early to mid-1960s. Then we saw Mobutu Sese Seko seize power in 1965, and for the first few years, it didn't seem maybe so bad. His strongman ways at least lent a certain stability to Zaire as he renamed the country. And commodity prices were high enough for a time that the economy sort of did okay. But then, starting in the 1970s, we saw the long, slow, continual decline of the Zairean state. And by the time any of us, Tony and I were Peace Corps volunteers there around 1980-82, and of course we were already halfway through the Mobutu decline, the decline intensified, and by the time we got to the 1990s, as you all know, Congo, or DRC, was essentially a failed state, still known at that point as Zaire, Mobutu still in power, but not really able to control things. The East became a conflict zone, infamous for sexual violence and many other kinds of disgraces and tragedies, but also the complete collapse of the state led to an incredibly high mortality rate, not just from the violence, but from malnutrition and lack of proper medical care. And you'll remember that Ted Koppel and others did exposés on Congo in the late 90s, in which it was seen as perhaps the most lethal global conflict anywhere on Earth because of this sort of excess death phenomenon, as statisticians and epidemiologists would describe it, the fact that people were not able to be well-nourished or properly cared for because of the violence and the breakdown in the state. You know that by early 1997, Laurent Kabila marched with a group of soldiers from the east to the west, and I'm still not quite sure how he did that. It's got to go down as one of the greatest logistical feats in the history of warfare. I'm not sure Genghis Khan could have done any better, given what had to be traversed to get from east to west in the state that Congo's infrastructure was in at that time. But they actually got to the capital and overthrew what was left of the Mobutu regime. Mobutu himself died later that year. Kabila had 4 years of semi-rule. Describe it as you will, but of course he was assassinated in 2001 by some of his own people or own bodyguards, and then his son took over, and that's where I'm going to stop and turn things over to Tony. Joseph Kabila did win presidential elections in 2006 and 2011. That was supposed to have been it. Now we're at the point where who knows what comes next. So without further ado, thank you all for being here, and Tony, over to you to explain to us sort of where we are in the context of the Kabila presidency, bringing us up to date in modern Congo.
Thank you very much, Mike. Good morning, everybody. Thanks to Brookings for doing this. Another timely meeting on the Congo. We'll have lots to talk about. First, my apologies to people. I see many friends here. You will have heard what I'm going to say right now many times. So if you want to tune off or look at your cell phones or whatever, you can do that. But what I'm going to do is, for people who don't know the Congo so well, go briefly from the time Joseph Kabila took power in early 2001 to about 2016, so that others, as we get to the present and we get to what's going on today, what it means and what one might do about it, that we can discuss that with a kind of general base of knowledge. So as Mike said, the first thing I want to say, to back up a little bit. Yes, I am delighted that I'm now working as the executive director of the Ponzi Foundation USA. My remarks today are my own. I in no way am representing Ponzi Foundation or any employees, Dr. Mukwege, or anyone else associated with Ponzi. This is Tony Gambino speaking for himself. In 2001, Joseph Kabila took power. And there was still a war going on, the country divided basically in three parts. Things were stuck. There was a rough equivalence of forces with outside actors from Africa, countries like Zimbabwe, Angola, Rwanda, Uganda, heavily involved, supporting the government and various rebel groups. And there didn't really seem to be a way out. They were just stuck. Kind of like three mini countries. Joseph Kabila, with a lot of support from the international community, changed that and began serious negotiations that successfully led to a transition government that set up in Kinshasa in the middle of 2003 for a three-year transition that, as Mike said, ended with reasonably successful elections. They were not perfect. But they were reasonably free and fair. And I want to be very clear what I mean by that, because there's still debate, particularly among Congolese, about that. For those of us who really care about free and fair, transparent elections, there's a simple test, and it's this. No matter whether there was voter fraud, cheating, whatever, at the end of the day, when it's announced that this person won and this person lost, can you say with real confidence, that's correct? Maybe they won by 1 million votes. Maybe they won by 300,000 votes. I don't care so much about that. I want to know, was the person declared the winner actually the winner, or are things too confused? I was among the large group of people with the Carter Center who monitored the elections in 2006. There were many monitors and a very heavy involvement of the United Nations. The Carter Center concluded, we concluded, who were there monitoring, that those elections did meet that standard. And I still believe that. I know that that's an issue of some contention among some Congolese, but that's my view. So President Kabila was legitimately elected in 2006. And the Congolese constitution, adopted in 2005, sets up a two-term limit for the president. So he was supposed to have from 2006, if he won in 2011, till 2016. So what happened? Just for reasons of time, I'm going to skip over very rapidly his first term, 2011, second round of elections. Those elections were very poorly organized. They occurred under very problematic logistical circumstances, and credible observers, I was not an elections observer in 2011, but following the elections very carefully, credible elections observers, and I mean by that the Carter Center and the European Union observers, both came out and said in effect, and this is what the Carter Center actually said, we don't know who won. You can go back and read their report. There was an election. The two main candidates were President Kabila and Etienne Tshisekedi, recently deceased. They both got a lot of votes. President Kabila was declared the winner. The most careful observer said, we just don't know. We can't say, maybe he won, maybe he lost, maybe Tshisekedi won, maybe Tshisekedi lost. We don't know. Those elections failed the basic test of free, fair, transparent elections. At the same time, there were elections for the National Assembly. Those elections also failed. So although a new assembly was installed, it's one that comes into power based on a largely fraudulent election. So we have the second term, and I'll zip forward to 2015-2016. Preparations should have been underway for presidential elections with Joseph Kabila term limited. Those preparations were not undertaken in any serious way by the Congolese Electoral Commission. Those of us who were following it carefully kept pushing. We got to early 2016, and it was fairly clear that just on a logistical basis, it would be very difficult to hold elections on time. Further, at about that time, a new word that I hadn't heard used very often when people were speaking French came into the Congolese lexicon, and anyone here in this room following the Congo knows the word. That word, of course, is glissement. For those of you who don't speak French, glissement means sliding. You slide along. And it is still used to describe the strategy of President Kabila and his supporters, and that is to slide past election dates, constitutional requirements, and therefore to maintain power, not in a kind of overt, I'm staying in power forever, but just kind of sliding through various barriers, slipping around them, and somehow remaining there. Unfortunately, that characterizes what happened in 2016. There were various negotiation processes started, and I will leave those, one under the African Union by a facilitator named Kodjo, and then later in the year, one with the Catholic bishops under their umbrella called the Senko, but I'll leave the details of that to other speakers. But in terms of a broad overview, elections were supposed to be held in November. The President Kabila was supposed to leave office in mid-December. Neither of those things happened. President Kabila and his supporters got a reinterpretation of the Congolese constitution that said that that was okay. I won't go into the details, but basically they interpreted it to mean that if you don't have presidential elections, the sitting president remains legitimately in power indefinitely. All I'll say about that is that interpretation is highly disputed by many. Nonetheless, on April 10th, 2017, today, Joseph Kabila remains the president of the Congo, even though his 10 years in office constitutionally ended as of December 20th. That, too, is in high dispute, but that's where I'll end my little update.
Thank you, Tony. Fantastic and very clear. Very helpful. So, Nita, if I can now turn to you and, I guess, you know, frame things as you wish, but again, in the spirit of helping us understand where we are at this moment in DRC and all your work with NGOs, with various activists, sort of, this, you know, I'd be curious just the state of life as you see it in DRC today.
Thank you very much, Mike, and thank you for the working, for inviting me to represent the voice of the Congolese. I can see many Congolese here, and we all have almost the same face. We all feel despair, but at the same time, anger for what's happening in DRC because we've been here before. And I've been in this position before warning people what's going to happen to DRC if nothing is being taken seriously. And nobody ever takes Congolese seriously. And we repeat the same crisis in DRC every 5 to 6 years. We go back to the same crisis where everybody has to come together and try to appease the people and not the problem. So here we are, where we have a country, 2.7 million kilometers with 80 million of citizens, and the country has no law because, just like Tony has said, that the constitution is actually void since Kabila have refused to organize the election in December, because although the article and the Constitution Court said that Kabila can remain he can remain past December 19 because they don't want the country to have no leader. But at the same time, the same Constitution say that the transition can only last for maximum 120 days, which we're passing the 120 days here in April. So after this, the Constitution is completely void. So we have no laws to run the biggest country, one of the biggest country in Africa. And the last accord that the Catholic Church was trying to put together to give a legitimacy to whatever transition is going to be past April, it's also void because Kabila have succeeded to boycott everything that we're trying to do. And the question we have to ask ourselves, how we got to this? And I think it's everybody's kind of responsible, especially the international community. They kind of help Kabila maintain this sort of not country, governed country for a long time now. Every time they have excuse for him, or he was young when he became president, or it's not very in control of what he's doing. But the last week he showed us that he's pretty much in control. Every time he find the accord of December 31st was at the sense, it was not going forward because the Catholic Church could get people to agree on a particular, negociation particulière. It's very, between the politicians, they have to talk about how the government of the transition, arrangement particulier, where they're going to run the transition period. But then Kabila came, asked the church to stop the dialogue, and then in 2 days he came up with a solution in which he has appointed himself a new prime minister, and now he's trying to put together a government on his own. And since then he has asked the electoral commission to continue the effort to organize the election. So all this time, after this week, we find out that Kabila actually have power to move things around. He can organize the election when he wants to. He can appoint a prime minister that he wants to. He can do anything he wants. So we got to this because nobody really takes the Congolese voice seriously. In 2011, we've seen it. In 2011, when the election was very, very much a chaos, in other places, everybody would ask for the election to take place again, to have a second election, just to make sure that we know who won the election. But the international community was like, huh? We don't know who won, so so that's not up to us. Kabila can remain in power and do whatever he wants. And he figure out that there's nothing is going to happen to him if he continue to play around and not do what is asked from him. since then, he's been trying very hard to change the constitution, just like everybody else around in Africa. We've seen it in Rwanda, we've seen it in Congo, Brazzaville. Everybody's changing the constitution to remain in power. And for that, he has figured out that for him to remain in power is to hold the Congolese hostage. We've been hostage to Kabila since 2011, because right after the election, he sent out his military in Kinshasa and pretty much killed people with complete impunity. And then we find some mass grave in Kinshasa where people have disappeared, nobody knows where they are, and we have a mass grave that nobody's investigating about. And it's okay. Everybody's saying it's okay. Oh, maybe because... and then the international community response is, okay, maybe the Congolese should just go along. They shouldn't come out and protest. They shouldn't ask for their rights to protest on the street, because Kabila is going to shoot at them. It's amazing. A hostage, we're telling him to go along with the person who's prosecuting him. So that's where the Congolese are. After that, he's been trying and trying. And lately, what he did is he actually starting war in Kasai. The MONUSCO have said that Kabila has starting a war himself to avoid to organize the election this year. He's starting a war in Kasai where they found 23 mass graves. And worse, he has the courage to advertise that killing, because after that, they put on the social media videos of how they're killing the people. This is where we are. The Congolese are, they have no idea what they're going to do, because nobody is supporting them. They have been hostage of Kabila's violent presidency all this time, and people are telling them, you have just to go along. So that's where we are. We have a country with no law, where Kabila is building his own lucrative business because he's one of the richest person in Congo now. And the Congolese are being asked to go along with this. The question is, how far are we going along? How far the Congolese has to wait for a response to the crisis? Because after December, we all know Kabila wouldn't organize any election. I don't know if I'm you're understanding. I mean, for people who know Congo knows what I'm talking about, but people who don't know about Congo, I'm sorry. It's just that the Congolese are fed up a little bit on the response of the international community. Today, the Congolese have tried to organize a protest, and 2 days ago, the Kabila have put along the streets his military and his police to shoot out the people. And the response, especially the response from the U.S. embassy, was amazing. They told people both sides have to restrain from violence or to express violence thought. The violence is on one side. The people have the right to protest on the street, but the international community are telling them not to protest because they're afraid they're going to kill them. But this is where we are. When there's a crime, where the government is shooting on its own people with all the videos that we've seen on the internet, I mean, you would think the ICC will be involved at this time. Or you hear an outcry from somewhere. But for the Congolese, it's okay. We've been dying since the war starting back in the 90s. 6 million, they told us, have died since. But people still continue to die. There's 23 mass graves in the Kasai alone. So who knows how many mass graves we have around with all those militias, all those fighting that's been happening. So it looks like the Congolese dying doesn't really move people to do something positive. So I think right now we don't have a lot of solutions. The only solution we have here is...
We'll come to that. Okay. That's good. That's perfect. But I'm gonna add an editorial comment to back you up, which is I have to say that I think one of the sloppiest and most hackneyed diplomatic phrases is to call for restraint on all sides. It's insulting to people who are being afflicted, and it's something that diplomats fall back on when they have nothing else to say and haven't thought hard enough about the situation. Sometimes it's right. Sometimes it's the right thing to say, but a lot of times it's not. I just wanted to add that point. And thank you for talking about Kasai and Kinshasa and the whole country. But now, Dane, that sets you up very well to talk about the East. And another very important part, I'll just remind folks that, of course, in the early months of the Trump administration, we've had to have a debate at the UN about the peacekeeping force. And I believe the good news is that it's being sustained and not as deeply cut as had been originally feared. But it is being shaved back a bit at a point when there's no real exit strategy for helping train up the DRC military. And Tony's written a lot about this over the years. So look forward to your thoughts on that issue as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you, everyone, for coming this morning. I also want to just thank Mike and Brookings for hosting us. As one of our common friends said once, the rest of us try to write an article a week, and Mike writes a book a week. And so the Congolese community, the people in D.C. who are focused on Congo are grateful for Mike and the energy that he brings to the space. Also, thank you to Tony, who's been a friend over the last several years. There's not a more passionate advocate for the Congolese people in D.C. We're grateful for him and his energy. And Nita, I've only recently met, but every time I'm with her, I learn something new. So it's an honor to be up here. A quick comment about Eastern Congo Initiative, the organization that I run. We're founded by Ben Affleck, the actor. He's the chair of our board. We're not a political organization. We're founded to empower Congolese solutions to local development problems, mostly in the East. We do work in other parts of the country. I've been working in the region for 15 years and had the opportunity to visit Congo 6 times in the last 12 months, and spoke with our team on the ground there as well, based in Goma this morning, just to get any other updates. So it's obviously an important time to be having this discussion. From my perspective, an important point about what's going on in Congo right now is to say that the elections are obviously the biggest issue going on. They're the national issue that is affecting everything throughout the country. At the same time, if we were, which seems unlikely, able to have elections by the end of 2017, it would not be a panacea for everything that ails this country. So I think sometimes in the international community, this big, very important issue that is the linchpin to everything, we need to focus on it and make sure that the pressure and the carrots and sticks are applied such that we do have free and fair elections, but it will not solve everything in Congo. And there's a confluence of factors that I would argue lead this moment right now in Congo to being probably the most incendiary moment in at least 10 years in Congo, and maybe 20. And the first and foremost is the political uncertainty and how that cascades throughout the country. The second one has been mentioned about Kasai is the security issues. Also in North Kivu, where a lot of our staff work, there's been an uptick in insecurity and violence over the last year or two. And I'd say that overall, there's security issues are a big problem and are becoming more and more problematic. ECI led a program a couple of years ago, an advocacy program, to highlight security sector reform throughout Congo. And that's still a huge issue that needs to be resolved at many levels, national, regional, local levels. The third point about Congo, I think, in current day that we're not talking about enough is the economic issues. So as you all know, Congo has been one of the fastest growing economic countries in the world over the last 5 years, averaging over 7% economic growth. This year, that most projections from the IMF and the World Bank are coming in are 2%, maybe 4% economic growth. And that has huge implications for the lion's share of the population that are just trying to get by. A lot of when I talk to my Congolese friends and even our staff, and they talk about the elections, they really want elections to happen. They really want free and fair elections to happen. But more than anything, they just want to get by every day. 2/3 of the country, of the 80 million people, live on less than $2 a day. So this is one of, obviously, the poorest countries in the world. And there's a big currency devaluation problem right now as well. The commodity prices over the last year, over the last several years, that have driven the economic boom in Congo, have experienced a downturn. And that's led to some macroeconomic instability issues. And the currency has been devaluating at a rapid rate over the last year. And that's often what people are feeling the most on the ground, is that, you know, buying food and the price of fuel is just increasing exponentially. So from my perspective and just the overall context is that the elections are the most important thing going on, but there's many factors that are creating this a really difficult and troubling time in Congo right now.
Fantastic overview of the situation as well. And thank you for the emphasis on the economy. And now for talking about what to do about it. And we're just going to begin this conversation up here and then obviously involve you as well. Nita, if I could, I'll begin this round with you. And you sort of teed us up for a natural continuation. Obviously, you're extremely concerned about the behavior and the strategies of the current president. And I wondered if you could say a few words. I think you were going to suggest how Congolese themselves, but also perhaps the international community, needs to think about that issue of dealing with President Kabila, given his apparent emerging strategy for what he might be up to here. And then I know Tony and Dane will pick up on that line of thought as well. So back to you.
Sure, sure. It looks to the Congolese, for instance, that the international community already made up their mind that they're just going to manage Kabila. If he succeeds of staying, why not? He can stay and do whatever he wants as long as there's a little bit of stability. We've seen in 2016, at the end, there was a lot of pressure on Kabila to do good, to organize the election and try to maintain the constitution going. But then it didn't work. And then Kabila succeeded on going over because he was able to bribe some of the opposition, call on another dialogue, because most of the time when you don't want to find a solution on something, you just call people to talk, dialogue. So since 2011, where he didn't win the election, but nobody knows who won, he has organized three dialogues. The Concertation Nationale to try to kind of bring everybody to work with him, to glisser, like everybody says, and it didn't work. In 2015, everybody was talking about we need a dialogue so that everybody can participate and have a consensus a transition government to go through election. And that one was signed in October 10th with the help of the African Union, and it didn't work because Kabila himself is doing everything not to get the dialogue to go forward. And then they organized another one in December with the church, and same thing. He did the same thing, and he did not go through. So now we're here where there's no accord, there's nothing, and we're sure, everybody, you hear the EU call or every international call say, we need to go back to the dialogue. We need to go back to the implementation of an accord that pretty much has no more sense, because Kabila already appointed two prime ministers between this accord without help of the opposition. So he doesn't really need the opposition to organize the election because he's doing the enrollment and everything else. So we're having the same solution. We are now working from the international community, and they keep sending us back to the same solution. I think the international community have really to look into what they're asking on the Congo, and it's not working. They have to do more. We saw last year with the sanction and everything and pressure, Kabila he was a little bit willing to do something. But when the sanction phased off, he went back to who he was. I mean, the international community can at least up their pressure, at least to see something happening in 2017. I understand that the election is not the only solution, but we have to start somewhere. I can't speak on the Congolese side. I think the majority of the Congolese want that election. They want to see a new president because Kabila have failed the people. The poverty is so high, you can't even imagine. There's nothing going on. There's an economical crisis, like you say. There's a security crisis that himself is creating to maintain himself in power. So we cannot allow him to succeed on what he's trying to wave the violence on the people, so that people will let him stay. And when he stays, what he does is not even helping the people. We can even explain what he's doing. What we know is he's now very rich. He owns all the business in Congo. His family and friends are doing well, but the remaining of the population are very, very poor and continue to suffer. And it's not even his issue. He doesn't even care if people are going by every day having food or anything. So that's the part of the international community. They have to put benchmark. That makes sense. Not benchmark, and then when we arrive to that time, they say, oh, man, we don't know. He succeeded. Oh, wait, let's go another round of the same thing that's not working. They have to threaten Kabila seriously and show him the serious of what he's doing. We cannot have a country as big as Congo with no laws. I mean, when we had a constitution, he barely was able to maintain the country stable. Now that we have no laws, it's become the law of the strong person. If you have a gun or anything, you can make your own kingdom, whatever you are. So that one is the part of, we have to make sure that we go back to the law of the Congo. We have to go back to a country that functions just like every other country.
So thank you.
So that's on the Congolese side, we have no choice but to fight. I mean, I'm sure everybody here believes with me. The Congolese has to fight. They have to be on the streets. We have to show Kabila that violence, if he brings violence, he has to receive violence back. Not violence, guns, but he has to have people on the streets demanding the same thing. And then whoever has the ability to threaten with military actions, if he doesn't do right, should do it, because then you will understand the seriousness of the people. If people keep going on talking, he knows it's the joke. The talk doesn't work.
Thank you. Tony, this leads naturally to, I think, what I was hoping you'd talk about next, which are, you know, what are our policy options in the West? Anita's alluded to sanctions. I know there are some sanctions in place now against maybe some of Kabila's inner circle. Maybe you could talk about that and anything else that you think is within our toolkit here for dealing with the crisis.
Thank you, Mike. The first thing I'll say is Mike has been organizing these sessions on the Congo for many, many years. I've lost count how many of these you've had.
Goes back to the Susan Rice days when she was joining us before she went to the Obama administration.
She was at Brookings, yeah. And for those of you who have come to a bunch of them, I'd ask you to notice something quite remarkable here. In most of them, there has been a senior U.S. government official talking about U.S. policy. Various over the years, sometimes more convincingly, sometimes less so, but always a U.S. government official. Why is there no one here today? It's because there's no one in the Trump administration to invite. Who would one invite today? There is not even a nominee for Assistant Secretary for Africa. There is someone who is functioning as a special representative for the Great Lakes, but not apparently able to take any forward-leaning policy action. So in effect, without any disrespect intended to him, keeping a seat warm. We don't have an ambassador in Kinshasa. Our previous ambassador, Jim Swan, left after the end of last year. There's been not even a nominee to go through the Senate to have another ambassador in Kinshasa. So frankly, the American response to Congo right now is a disgrace. A disgrace. We have important things going on that all of us are talking about. The United States has tried. We can argue about how successful, but the United States has tried at various points over the years. Going back to what I talked about, bipartisan, the Bush administration was in power during the transition, did quite a bit to support the transition. The Obama administration, of course, in power after that, tried various things. Two special envoys, former Senator Russ Feingold and now Tom Perriello, presently running to be the next governor of Virginia. So fairly senior American politicians took on the role of trying to find a way forward in the Congo. We don't have that. That's my first point. Now let's move to the United Nations. And I'll start with the United States. As everyone here knows, I think, there has been some reconsideration of peacekeeping operations. And Ambassador Haley gave a speech at the Council on Foreign Relations a few weeks ago talking about this. I'm happy to say, as Mike already alluded to, that in that discussion, more moderate voices prevailed. So MONUSCO received another one-year extension of its mandates. A slight reduction in its forces, but they're still at 15,000, so still fairly robust, and still an extremely robust mandate. That said, it is clear for those of us who are watching the American administration that, as we're seeing at the highest levels, there are struggles between what I will characterize as somewhat more moderate people and quite extreme people. The same thing is happening at the United Nations. And there are still some people who think that peacekeeping is not worth it, that we should get rid of it, it's not a useful thing, or looking for various ways to undermine it. We can criticize the MONUSCO mission in the Congo, and I would be the first to offer some criticisms. But I'll submit to you that if that mission would leave the Congo right now, we would see collapse and we would see disarray. For all the failings of MONUSCO, and there are many, it is one of the few tissues that is holding together this country so that we don't move into a scenario of complete collapse. And let no one in this room forget, this is a country that collapsed in the late 1990s. So we're not speaking theoretically. Just in the last couple decades, we've seen that. So maintaining a reasonable peacekeeping mission for the near term is important. If people are interested, there is a potential exit strategy. For time reasons, I won't talk about that now. But it is clear that this is not the time for an exit. I want to also say a little bit about the Europeans and some African states. The European Union, like the United States, moved last year to impose sanctions on certain actors that are part of President Kabila's government. Those sanctions had some effect in suggesting that the United States and the European Union were serious in moving for some changes in the Congo. As I said, U.S. policy seems to be going in a different direction. The European Union has come out with some strong statements recently, as have the government of Belgium. In Africa, we have been watching three states in particular, to the east of Congo, Rwanda, to the west of Congo, Angola, and in the south of the continent, South Africa, as three of the most important African states who continue to follow the Congo and try to take action. South Africa obviously having some very severe problems of its own right now, appearing to be spending a little less time focusing on the Congo. But Congo's neighbors, particularly its powerful neighbors, Angola and Rwanda, continue to pay very close attention. Neither of those countries are paragons of democracy, but neither of those countries, I don't think, wants to see the kind of instability that we saw in the late 90s on their borders, so that's something to watch. Final point I'll make, as Nita described, we have had various agreements, the most recent being the New Year's Eve Accord of December 31st, brokered by the Congolese bishops. In the newest mandate for MONUSCO, for the UN mission, much of the mandate is centered around helping the Congolese implement the New Year's Eve Accord. Unfortunately, many international observers, and in statements from the European Union and the Belgian government, they believe, and many others are writing about this right now too, the New Year's Eve Accord is dead. If the New Year's Eve Accord is dead, there is nothing left for the international community to focus on. In 2016, the focus could be in 2015, hold elections, have that. Well, that didn't work out so well. Now, with this recently adopted mandate for MONUSCO, it has all been implement the New Year's Eve Accord. Well, if the New Year's Eve Accord has gone by the boards, what do they grasp onto? And I think one is left in thinking about what Nita has said, that we have a president who has used a constitutional court decision to say he can remain in power, but his legitimacy clearly wanes with every day. And that is true of all the institutions of the state. It's true of the parliament. It's true as you go across the board. And so unless we can get to elections to recreate the basic legitimacy of the fundamental state institutions, all of us fear that this is a country headed towards collapse once again.
Thank you, Tony. Dane, over to you, and please feel free to pick up on whichever of these issues or others that you'd like to address for policy imperatives and options going forward.
Sure. There's so much to discuss here, and fortunately we'll open it up and be able to discuss with all of you as well. I would echo many of, if not all of the things that Nita and Tony both mentioned. I'd say I'll focus my remarks right now on what can we do here, and how can we help in this process? I agree with Tony that the December 31st agreement is on ice right now, and it's on shaky ground. But there is no real alternative. We have to find a way to implement this agreement because it was the only agreement that had credibility among all of the main opposition groups. And it's the only reason why there's not a larger outbreak of war right now. What can we do here? I would echo that the Trump administration has not been particularly engaged yet in Africa and in Congo specifically. And we are coming off the heels of Tom Perriello, Russ Feingold, really strong special envoys. So I would echo that there's a couple critical things that we need to do. One is just increasing our engagement overall, and that's in terms of budget, people, and I'd say leadership in international circles. So the budget, we all know that there is a skinny budget up on the Hill, and we're all talking about what does it mean to be engaged in the international, particularly in poor countries around the world, and where does it fit within our strategic interests. There's an interest for all of us to engage in that conversation. And in particular, there's been significant investments in Congo that have allowed, despite all of the statements that we've made today about we're in a very perilous position, if you look back over Congo over the last 10 years, I always say in security, but in other ways too, there's episodic things that get headlines. M23 comes in, but the overall trajectory has been a decrease of violence and an increase in development. Poverty rates have actually decreased significantly over the last 10 years. There's a long ways to go. But there's been steady progress under Kabila and in this current, over the last 10 years in this current political context. So what we need is to make sure we use all of our levers to maintain that. And part of that is using our budget to invest in things that work on the ground. Public-private partnerships for poverty alleviation. ECI does a lot of that, working with Starbucks, Theo Chocolate, Lush Cosmetics are all sourcing sustainably in Congo, in agriculture, improving farmers' incomes, and at the same time, improving livelihoods. So one is, I'd say, what we can do is engage with Congress on the budget. Two is people. Tony mentioned all the people that have not yet been filled. The assistant secretary, the special envoy, which we argue should be brought back to a special envoy level as opposed to a special representative level. The senior director for Africa at the White House, still vacant. It's one, you know, maybe the second most important position on Africa in the U.S. government. So there's some critical positions in addition to the ambassador. And then the third is, I think, leadership in the international community. The U.S. has played a critical role in Congo, and there is a vacuum right now because the U.S. is pulling back, also because CENCO, the Catholic bishops that have been the mediator that have led to the December 31st agreement, have pulled back as of 2 weeks ago. So there is a vacuum of influence in terms of mediation, in terms of being a listener, in terms of being an engaged power in this context. And Mike mentioned, and Tony talked about it, the MONUSCO mandate. And it was approved last week and continued for another year, decrease of 3,000 troops. But we don't see that actually as necessarily a bad thing. And if you look at Nikki Haley's comments, she's not wrong. We can do more with less with MONUSCO. I agree with Tony, it's absolutely imperative that MONUSCO maintain a presence for the foreseeable future. But there's ways that MONUSCO can be more effective with its resources. We all know that. And also in an operational way, the decrease in troops, the 19,000 that had been previous mandate, we were usually never around that. We were usually around 17,000. So to go down to 16,000, there won't be a major operational impact. But it is a good opportunity to say, how can we use these troops most effectively? And I think the new mandate is aggressive and also makes sense, both to protect the civilians as priority number one, and also to help implement this December 31st agreement upon which everything hinges. So there's a lot going on. It's a very complex environment. There are things that we can do.
Excellent. I think we'll go to all of you now. And what I'd ask is that you wait for a microphone. Please identify yourself, and please keep your question to just one per person if we could, because I'd like to get a number of voices in. I know there are going to be a lot of people here with a lot of expertise and passion on this subject.
So we'll start with the gentleman right there to your left in the plaid shirt, and then we'll also take the gentleman here in the fourth row after that.
Hi, good morning. My name is Christopher Dujardin, and my question is for Tony, I believe. You mentioned earlier that the current administration has not put forward nominees for either Assistant Secretary of State for Africa or as an ambassador to the Congo. Have you heard any talk of whether he might be nominating somebody to those positions, or, as he said before, if he hasn't filled the positions, he's not going to because he doesn't think they need to be filled? I just didn't wonder if you heard that.
Thank you. I know we got a question here in the fourth row.
Thanks a lot. My name is Mr. Jean-Pierre Lukamba. I'm the vice chairperson for African Diaspora Forum, and I was also part of the almost all the Congolese dialogue from Sun City to Pretoria last year to dialogue. And I was invited 2 days ago to United Nations Security Council to share with them my independent perspective regarding the situation in the DRC. But what our colleague shared there, actually I'm supporting also their statement, but... The first one, when I met Thomas Pierrot in South Africa, I think it was 2015, when he was recently appointed, I asked him, we are seeing the same scenario in Rwanda, in Angola, in another country like Burundi. And because when we are doing something, must be able also to give also certain answer. Like if people will ask us why we are putting too much pressure in the DRC in Congo, but not in those African country, he told me that DRC is not like any other African country. And another one also with Senko talks, I think Anita knows that the opposition started even to discuss with the current government with, informally, and it was agreed that one of the leader from the opposition will be the prime minister. But why now the international community, African Union, come in power, they appointed Eden Kojo as the facilitator of Congolese dialogue. Something happened in Jeval and so on. And since then, they are not willing to discuss. They didn't willing to discuss with other party like the civil society and the government. And I think 3 days ago, because I was also part of the preparatory committee representing the whole Congolese diaspora in that the Cité de l'OIA dialogue. Actually, we pulled out from that dialogue because we just saw that other potential party were not part of the dialogue, like Rassemblement and so on. And we left the dialogue with the Senko, Jonas Chombela from the New Civil Society, and myself. Actually, I was invited by the State Department to share also the situation of the DRC. And when we went back, I just picked something. If you want to change the direction of the bus, how can you try to do it while we are outside of the bus? And I think the good strategy is that if you want to change the direction of the bus, you must be inside of the bus and push and get some influence so that you can change the direction by influencing the driver. And my question is...
I'm going to take that as a comment. It's a helpful comment.
Yeah,
I'm going to go somewhere else for a question, if you don't mind, because I want to include a few more voices.
No, I want to ask a question.
Go ahead.
Yeah. My question is that from the international committee, we had U.S. Support since 1960 when our country got independence, and they were supporting us. And until 1916, and they are no longer supporting the Congolese people, especially all of you say you talk about the U.S. Administration and so on. My question is that why now, before they support the DRC, they supported the Congolese, but now nobody is willing to support the Congo, especially the stability, peace, and so on. That is actually my question.
That's such a big 30,000-foot question, but I'm gonna take one more in addition, and then people can comment on whichever they choose. So the woman in the white shirt, a couple rows back. Yes, please.
Hi, yes, my name's Tara Canlin. I have a question on the physical security in the country as well, particularly in the East. I'm focused mostly around Beni and the Kivus. As we've seen a proliferation of groups, the mass graves in Kasai, the UN group of experts and their Congolese colleagues also who were kidnapped. How is the political situation playing into that, the insecurity there? Do you anticipate that that's going to get any better if we see elections? Where do you see that going? Thank you.
So why don't we start with Tony, and especially because the first question was posed directly to you, and then people can just comment on whichever they wish.
I'll talk about the first two questions briefly. In terms of the positions, there is a name out for the senior director at the National Security Council. He's a terrorism expert, probably well known to you, Mike. Not someone known for knowing a whole lot about Central Africa. But at least there's a name out. So I think we'll see a senior director for Africa at the National Security Council soon. On the Assistant Secretary for Africa, there are various names out, but they seem still to be so far away from making any choices that I wouldn't even talk about the names that you see occasionally in the various stories that come out. What I would say is compare it to what happens historically. There are more than three dozen top positions at the State Department below the level of the Secretary of State. The Trump administration, as of today, has not nominated one person. No one has been nominated to fill any of those positions. Deputy Secretary of State, a whole set of Undersecretaries of State, and then a much larger group of assistant secretaries, including the Assistant Secretary for Africa. There's not a single nomination for any of those positions. I believe I'm right, Mike, in saying that's completely unprecedented. I've certainly never seen that in Washington. Now to your specific question about the Assistant Secretary for Africa. Usually, that person is nominated around now, April, May, and then he or she is confirmed a month or two afterwards. So normally by sometime in the spring, no later than the early summer of the first year of an administration, the key Washington-based person, the Assistant Secretary for Africa, is on the job. I'm hearing people say, I hope they're wrong, that we may not get a nomination and we may not see an Assistant Secretary until much closer to the end of calendar 2017. I hope those rumors are wrong. But that's what's in the air right now on that. On the question about the broader international community, what I say about is this. In terms of responding to these very tough issues in the Congo, a lot of us have been saying for a long time, number one, we want to do everything we can to support the legitimate aspirations of the people of the Congo. As Nita is saying, the people of the Congo, I'm hearing it from any number of contacts throughout the diaspora, but also in the Congo, in the government, out of the government, in Kinshasa, across the country, rich, poor, whatever. They would like to see the Constitution respected. They would like to see elections. They would like to see a new government come in. So in addition to actions by the people of the Congo, we have felt for a while that effective pressure in support of that from the international community could give us the combination to respond to these legitimate aspirations. There was an effort to do that last year. Obviously, it failed. We still see the Europeans showing some interest. We don't see it yet from the United States. And for those of us who try to make rough, very rough calculations of is there enough energy right now coming from the people in the Congo as well as the international community to get us back on what some people call a chemin de la paix, a road towards peace? I have to say with great regret, I think not.
That's probably right. Nita.
What I can say is that the pressure from within is being crushed very, very vigorously. Kabila has no refrain on sending his army just shooting, blatantly shooting the people on the streets. And it looks like from outside, looks like from the international community is okay, because he's been shooting to protest, putting, even back in December 19, when people didn't even protest. They were back in their homes using whistles to show that Kabila's term was finally ending. They send the military to kill people in the home. And there's no outcry. There's no outcry. That's because there's no outcry, and people are beating around the bush on what we're supposed to be doing. I remember back since the resolution of the UN asking for a dialogue, everybody has said that if we find out that somebody or a group of people are becoming an obstacle to the election or to democratization of the DRC, they will be personally met with sanction or they will be responsible. But Kabila has been doing that for the past 4 years. There's no sanction. There's nothing that would ask him to do another way. I mean, he's been used to doing that, and people are finding excuse to let him do that, kill people, create, and even put video on Facebook of his army shooting women and children in Kasai. And there's no outcry. They're asking the people to wait, to go back to the dialogue. Let him leave the power with respect. What is the respect for the people of Congo? There's no respect. Women have been raped all the time. People have been killed. There's no respect for the Congolese people. And they're saying, the international community keeps saying, we're supporting the people. But what we see, the Congolese, they're supporting Kabila, because he succeeded on becoming president after the constitution. He is the only single person who failed the constitution, failed all these accords. There's no other person. It's him. So why is the outcry when he become the problem for Congo prosperity? We need to see that. We need the international community to leave, not becoming the problem with Kabila, but becoming the support of the people so that Kabila can feel some pressure from outside. If that doesn't happen, we know exactly what's going to happen. Back in the 90s, what happened is everybody took on. That's where we're going. That's where everybody's telling the Congolese, you need to fight back. And I'm sure at one point, the Congolese will get that message and will fight back, because they've been promised that they will be, Kabila will leave in 2016, and he didn't leave. They've been promised that if Kabila become an obstacle to the problem, he will be met with sanction. There's still no sanction. We're sanctioning individuals that have nothing to do with him, because he has power. We've seen it. He decides what the court does. He decides which opposition individual go to jail. He decides everything on his own. Where is Kabila's sanction when he's become the obstacle to Congo prosperity and democracy?
Thank you.
That's what we're asking. And to answer the question, the two experts was not kidnapped. They've been murdered. That's what we have to say. Stop beating around the bush. Yeah. They've been murdered in Kasai, where Kabila has his troop over there saying that they're protecting or they're trying to quiet a rebellion. Two experts, one American citizen and one Swedish woman, got killed and decapitated in the Kasai, and still no outcry neither.
Dame.
So on the quick question about nominations from the Trump administration, just to echo what Tony said, it's not as though the Trump administration is strategically deciding we're not going to fill these. Obviously, this is caught up in the broader politics of this administration, and it's also about priorities. So obviously, these issues that are not at the top of the agenda for them, and so that's why they're not getting filled. At some point, we all think they will get filled. What we're just trying to say is that there's big strategic implications for having those vacancies. On the security issues, I would echo what Nita said. I would also mention that a lot of the, especially in the East, but this is the case in Kasai as well, that the insecurity didn't start because elections aren't happening. We're going to get arms and raise up. Often, this is a huge country the size of Western Europe, very diverse. There's local grievances and local elites who maybe are pitting themselves against other groups in the areas. And what the unknown at the national level is, it kind of exacerbates things. And sometimes the government is involved in these things, for sure. In in Beni over the last several years, there's been killings that there's been a lot of unknowns about exactly what's happening. Is the ADF involved? Is the Congolese government involved? Why are these things happening? What we do know for sure is that the uncertainty at the national level exasperates the situation. And as the local grievances maybe start the problems, but then the uncertainty at the national level just compounds it. So Kasai is a good example of what happened. There was a question about succession of a local chief. And it, by the best way that we can understand, is it was mishandled by local authorities about how this succession would happen. And who would be the successor. And then ultimately, that person was then assassinated. Then a local group, almost like the Mai Mai in the East, raised up and said, this isn't right, you're mishandling this, we should be able to name our own successors and to manage this ourselves. And as the government tried to tamp things down, the elections and the national situation kind of added to the fervor and spread across the region. Kasai is one of the most peaceful places. We haven't had instability in Kasai since the 60s. And now we have a major problem that both for what's happening to the, you know, mostly what's happening to the local people there. 40 or maybe 52 policemen were beheaded last week. Mass atrocities of the local population. But then, of course, over, you know, a couple weeks ago, even UN group of experts were killed, as well as their translator. And their drivers have still not been found, but it just raises the profile of this very volatile situation.
I'm going to throw out one idea before we go to another round of questions, which is that as we struggle as an international community with the idea of watching some presidents essentially try to use elections in one way or another, or in this case, the lack of elections, and become presidents for life, I wonder if we need some broader way of thinking about this. And we talked about it last time we had an event here, and Tony and I have talked about it a lot. I'm still struck that the United States would never have tolerated Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan having a third term. We essentially told him if he wanted the continued support of the international community with peacekeeping troops and with massive economic aid, that he was going to have to respect the process. And that was in the Obama years. You know, I don't know how President Trump would have handled that same situation. But I wonder if it's time for a law or a a doctrine, if you will, that basically says if you want American aid, you must have a maximum of two terms. There could be a national security waiver in an extreme case, but then you put the onus on those who wish the waiver. And so if we had this law today, I might propose that we temporarily have a waiver for Paul Kagame in Rwanda, who has a lot of blemishes on his record, but who has brought some degree of stability and on balance, I think, has a better track record than Joseph Kabila. But we could also serve notice this exemption won't be forever. Anyway, this kind of an idea, I think the debate may need, whether I'm right or not about these specifics. The United States, has a strong interest in seeing a peaceful transfer of power, establishing that tradition around the world. And right now, we don't know what to do when we've got a Museveni in Uganda or a three-term president in Burundi or Paul Kagame in Rwanda. We know what to do with Mugabe. We know that we just basically have cut him off. It feels good. It doesn't accomplish an outcome, but in other cases, I think we're struggling, and I wonder if this kind of a framework might be a useful one to introduce. That's just my moderator's prerogative with editorial comment. Now we'll go to the gentleman here in the fifth row, and then we'll come back to, we'll take two more in the fourth row.
My name is Martin Matamba. My question is directed to any one of you, and then I have a comment. My question is mainly, do you, any one of you, think that the situation in the Congo today, the international or conglomerate organizations, do they bear any responsibility for what is going on in the Congo today? Because the minerals are being taken out of the earth every day. In the region where there are conflicts, they're still doing their work. Do they bear any responsibility? And my comment basically is, despite everything we discuss, nobody has really addressed the main problem Congo faces, which is Congo is an occupied country. It's a country under occupation by foreign powers, mainly through Rwanda and Uganda. Until that has been addressed, there's no way. But I'm going to then follow what my sister there said, that the Congolese have to take up arms, and then it's not going to be a failed state again. We're going to take arms and we're going to defend ourselves. Then everybody was going to pay attention to what the Congolese really feel today.
Thank you. And then we'll take these two right next to each other in the fourth row. Right there, yeah.
Thank you very much. My name is Guillaume Demba. She know me very well. I'm a Homeland Security Specialist. I said something, I need three questions.
One question, please.
One question.
Keep the pace going.
Okay. So we've been talking about Congo years and years. Okay? We don't have a plan. So we need to change the strategy to deal with diaspora, to do something in Congo. We've been years and years talk about Congo, go in Wilson Center, come back here, go over there. Nothing happened. We don't deal with diaspora. We talk about Congo, but we don't do nothing. We need to do something now. Plan, strategy. No talk about Congo, and we don't do nothing. Here's the year. Now is the end. We see what he does say? You need to take army. No use army. We have strategy. We have something to do. We have something inside. We come here to learn something with this country. So we're going to do something now. We need to work together with diaspora. So we'll try to work to government in Congo. Nothing going to happen. Kabila, he going to stand. If we don't work together with diaspora, we're supposed to work together here. No work with the Congolese in the ground. Nothing is going to work.
Okay, thank you.
You got to remember this question today.
Would you then pass the microphone to the woman next to you?
That's for you. Okay. Thank you. I'm Virginia Beard. I'm a political science professor focused primarily on East Africa. My question sort of builds on this gentleman's, and it's the economic side of the conversation. We've talked more about political things, about sanctions and the role the U.S. should have in appointing the different officers. But what about the role of the multinational corporation? I mean, primarily why it seems Kabila staying in power is his family owns all the economy, right? And so what role is there for the economic side of the political, both domestically and the role of the international community in their partnerships with, you know, it seems like Kabila's not going to want to leave as long as the money's still coming in and the corporations internationally that are partnering with are bringing a lot of those resources.
Thank you. Danny, would you like to start with this round?
Sure. So on the first question, does the international community bear responsibility for some of the context in Congo, particularly on the minerals? As you know, over the last couple of weeks in D.C., there's been an ongoing discussion about the Frank Dodd and the 1502 law about conflict minerals in Congo and how those are sourced. I will leave it to some of my colleagues for how to best debate that, but I think it's an important discussion. On the last question about multinational corporations and the President Kabila's ownership, obviously a lot of people think that's what's behind him wanting to stay in power. There's other considerations as well, though. Many African leaders, when they lose power, are often in legal trouble or physical danger as well. And so I think, you know, there's a multitude of reasons why he would, if, you know, assuming and hopefully he will exit at an appropriate time, that he would want to make sure those things were in place. I would echo that, you know, again, I mentioned this at the beginning, that Congo is a very, you know, huge, vast, diverse country. And in the east where we work, there's, you know, Congo has enough arable land to feed 1/3 of the world. And where we work, there's vast agricultural potential as well. I think in a lot of the companies that you're talking about are more in the commodities and the extraction industries. But there are a growing number of socially minded, environmentally sustainable companies that want to work in Congo, and that's because of the potential. We've been working in coffee in Congo for the last several years. And just a year ago, Starbucks released its first single-origin coffee from Eastern Congo, which you can buy in 1,600 stores in the U.S. and Canada. And what you see is, especially in the coffee industry, Congo is one of the last frontiers where the quality is so high, and yet there's a way to invest in that coffee as well as invest in the people and as well as actually make it, you know, improvement in lives. And so that's different than some of the commodities and the extraction. But one of the things we try to do at ECI is try to tell the whole story and different stories that aren't told as much about Congo. And some of the war and the disease and conflict and those are prevalent, but that's not the whole story. Anyone who's visited Congo finds an incredibly vibrant, entrepreneurial, optimistic, resilient population. So those are a few comments.
Great, thank you. Nita, you care to comment?
Sure, that's true. Just to say what you just said, that's many presidents in Africa don't want to leave when it's time to leave because they're afraid that their life or the business. It's not because they did good that their life is in danger. Kabila has to go to prison for killing so many people. I mean, that's not because he did good to the Congolese people that Congolese people are ready to kill him. He did some crime. He stole money. I mean, he's a billionaire somehow. I don't know his salary. He allowed him to do that. That's one reason that they're having issue because, again, when it's time to leave, when the mandate is over, most of them don't want to leave. They create violence. They create chaos. That makes that when they leave, people have justification. Otherwise, the reason we end up here today, we have all those militias in the East, so you work in the East, is because the impunity was so amazing. I mean, every time people took arm in Congo, the solution was, let's get them together, let's put all the militia together, form the army. Now we have an army of militias. Now, it didn't help nothing. We back to the same way we were because nobody wanted to tackle the issue that we were. Because if there were justice, if we had people were put in jail for what they did, today would have been better. But people are giving solutions that's not helping Congo at all. They're just protecting some sort of stability. That's not even stability because every 10 years, every decade or so, we're going back to the same thing because the solutions are not adequate. So we have to think outside the box. We cannot keep giving the same solution and saying that, oh, Kabila has to leave on his own term because he's going to be arrested for sure for doing all those chaos he did in Congo. That's for sure. And I hope that ICC will pick it up and send mandates for him to get arrested because the crime he committed is really high. I mean, we have Jean-Pierre Bemba, one of the former vice president of the DRC. He's in jail in the ICC because his military went to help Bozizé in Central Africa. A couple of his military committed a couple crimes. They killed three people. They stole some goats. And he's spending 18 years in prison in the ICC. Kabila, since he's been in power, how many people his military killed? We even have videos. We have to say it. We have videos of his military filming the way they're shooting women and children protesting in front of him. I mean, that's where we are. He's going to jail not because he's been nice. He's going to jail because he's committed crime.
I'm just going to make a quick comment before turning this to Tony, which is that it's just very sad to see where we are. We had an event last August with the Congolese ambassador to the United States, and Tony was part of that too, and it was a lot more hopeful tone in that conversation than there is today, just to state the obvious. But
sure, I only want to talk about the two questions relating to the role of international business. So the first thing I want to do, I'm not ascribing this point of view to either of the questioners, but let's think about this briefly historically. If people in this room don't know about it, you should know about the legacy of the Congo, starting with King Leopold and the Belgian colonial period and how horrible that was. And so among the horrors of that was the use of large companies. Société Générale was the big Belgian one that controlled so many things, including the extremely lucrative mineral extraction. That gets us up to the 1960s. That continued post-independence and was even the major reason for the splitting off of Katanga, and a war and all the suffering in the Congo. That's the 1960s. Let's fast forward now to 2017. That doesn't describe the situation in the Congo at all. Listen to this. There is zero major American company in the Congo today. Zero. Zero. What Dane was talking about, it's great stuff. It's really small. It's really small. I'm all in favor of it. But it's tiny, tiny, tiny. The last major American mining company, Freeport-McMoRan, has left the Congo. So in terms of the United States, zero. When we think about international business today, what's going on? And there have been fabulous press reporting on this. So for people who are interested, you can Google and find some really great articles. There was a very important businessman, not an American, named Dan Gertler. Dan Gertler, I'm just talking about public record now. Dan Gertler bribes senior Congolese officials, including President Kabila, to run a racket relating to Congolese mining companies. Let me tell you briefly how it works, because it matters. The Congolese still have a state company called Gécamines, which owns mines. Those mines, theoretically, are extraordinarily valuable. So let's have a mine that, I'll just make up these numbers, that might be worth $1 billion. They sell it to Dan Gertler for $30 million. I'm making up these numbers, okay? But you can find real numbers in some of these articles. Well, Dan Gertler can flip that in a period of months and sell it, not for $1 billion, but let's say for $300 or $400 or $500 million. How much money does Dan Gertler make? And by the way, how much money has the Congolese government made? Think about it. Those are the kinds of deals, first point. Second, China, which was a non-factor economically in the Congo, has become a very important economic factor in the Congo in this century. The deals, are they corrupt? Not on a Gertler scale. The Chinese have been looking to get minerals for their own developments, and they've gotten some. The Chinese are not particularly interested in democracy, but I don't see them running the kind of corrupt racket, nor do I see them having anything like the kind of influence that Société Générale or large multinationals had much earlier in Congo's history. Then, as Dane said, we have a concern about conflict minerals that we see specifically in the Dodd-Frank Section 1502 on it. But the point I want to make now is those conflict minerals are mined basically entirely artisanally. There is not any major company in the Congo that are mining the coltan or whatever. It is what happens, and what 1502 is about, is trying to trace it. So if something that some poor little boy or girl is digging out of an unsafe mine in the Congo, makes it to Rwanda or whatever, and then makes its way usually to Asia, and then is processed, and then, but yet somehow it ends up in your iPhone, well, let's try to think about that and think about what are ultimately the responsibilities for an Apple or for an Intel or for larger corporations. That's a good initiative. But my main point here is don't conflate that in any way with the very sad history of the role of major, mainly European multinationals in the Congo going back to the colonial period.
Thank you. So we have...
Mike, can I just make one quick comment?
Really quick, because we got to have one last round and then get out of here.
And I would just echo Tony's that it's counterintuitively to what we've been talking about. The Congo needs more international business investment. It's one of the most difficult places to do business in the world, but it's also a place of opportunity, as we've talked about.
So thank you. I'm going to go to we have two questions from the back, because I haven't, and the stage is so short here. I'm going to stand up so I can see people. And so the woman with her hand up on the left side there, and then, yes.
and then the gentleman in the pink shirt. And those will be the last two, and I'll have a quick set of responses, and thank you for your patience going a little bit over.
Hi, Christina from Security Assistance Monitor at the Center for International Policy. My question is mainly for Dane, but really for all of you. You mentioned Nikki Haley in discussing that peacekeeping really could do more with less. I'm curious, what does that look like for MINUSCO? How can we make peacekeepers more effective there?
Thank you. And then the gentleman over here, and we'll wrap up. Yes.
Hi, my name is Gustavo Nvel. I'm with the Committee for Free and Democratic Equatorial Guinea. My late father was an ambassador to Equatorial Guinea from 69 to 70. He was good friends with Patrice Lumumba. You know, I've been going to these things since 1991. I go back to days of Congressman Tom Lantos and Hans Holgraf, which was his legislative assistant. This, to me, is a shell game. These dictators are in power because there are multinationals who want them there. It's easier to deal with the known quantity of a dictator and talk about the smooth transition to democracy. We all know that Africa is not on the radar screen of the U.S. policy. So rather than, I mean, and with all due respect to the Brookings, American Enterprise Institute, NDI, RRI, all these, it's almost like there's just this cabal of individuals. We know that people like Kabila, like Teodoro Obiang, like Paul Biya, these people shouldn't even run a general store, let alone a country. So for those of us who are opposition folks who are educated here in the States, can you please equip us of how to get rid of these terrible folks who are anti-American, who are selling uranium to North Koreans? Because this is a shell game. I've been doing this since 1991. The same things are talked over and over. The smooth transition to democracy, free, fair, and transparent elections, rule of law, civil society. It's a shell game. So if you could just tell us, for those of us who want to go back to our countries, tell us what we need to do so that I'm not coming back here at the age of 75 hearing the same thing over and over and over again.
I'm going to say one quick thing, and then we'll just go down the row, and people will wrap up. And thank you. And I'm grateful for the audience having a lot of strong views as well as good questions. I'm going to say one broad point, which I think is appropriate given that we run this Africa Security Initiative at Brookings, and it's got a continent-wide scope. I'm not an expert on Africa, but there has been some hope on the continent. And you say that, and I'm glad for the hopeful points about even DRC's economy that we've heard today from Dane especially, but, you know, American foreign policy is not going to engage with the kind of decisiveness that, you know, would just solve the problem. And by the way, we tried that a couple of times in the Middle East the last 15 years. It turns out even when we try really hard, we don't always succeed. So you're not going to see that. And you might come back here. I hope we're both around into our 70s and 80s, and we'll probably be having events on democracy in Africa. But there are about a third of African nations today that are democracies by at least a rough metric. And that's a lot more than ever before. And there are about half the countries in Africa that are doing sort of okay economically. And that's a lot more than ever before. Unfortunately, today we're talking about one of the ones that is struggling. It's had some economic progress, but it's struggling on balance. But I just wanted to add that perspective. I'm glad for yours, but I just wanted to add my own as my final word, and now we'll work down the panel.
Well, I'll use this as my final comment, too, if you want that, Mike. The first thing I'll say is at least everyone that I can detect, either speaking or just getting the vibe, we're all really frustrated. And I want to end with that. I'm frustrated. And we're all trying to think about what to do. So quick comment on the last question. I will say I don't agree. I don't think this is a shell game. I do think we need elections in Congo. And I hear that from Congolese. So that's not, I happen to believe in it as an American. That's of some minor importance. More important, much more important, is that's what the Congolese who I talk to, Nita and many, many others, want. And so I think it's quite important to honor that and to try to find a way, credibly, to get there. Is it hard? Will we find success? I don't know. I'm frustrated. But I want to take that to launch into a larger point. And I really hope that people will start thinking about this. People are starting to despair in the Congo. And we have had an effort over the last few years to try to privilege peaceful protest, which is, first of all, part of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but is also explicitly permitted in the Congolese constitution. Explicitly permitted. And what Nita has said is unfortunately 100% accurate. The government has responded with lethal force to unarmed demonstrators across the country again and again and again for a number of years. And so today, when there were some calls for protest, the government deployed massively in major cities. There were arrests. I haven't heard of any deaths yet, but the deaths come because people are scared. People are scared. And Mike put it exactly right. Any lily-livered government, the United States or anyone, who wants to do this on the one hand, on the other hand, junk, deserves our opprobrium. This is a government that is attacking its own people, denying its own people their legitimate right of peaceful protest. What happens? What happens is people start saying it's not enough, and then they start thinking about turning to violence. And then what do we say, people who would like to find peaceful ways to get there? And this is not theoretical. It's not just some of the people in the room who are talking about that today. That's what people in the Congo are starting to ask themselves. That does not end well. It will end with even more people dead. It will ultimately end with Joseph Kabila leaving power. I remain convinced of that. Whether it's this year or next year, however that works out, that will happen. But it ends in another horrible bloodbath affecting the people of the Congo. And so I just ask everyone here, please, let's keep thinking. I'm sorry we don't have an answer today of how to get out of that. But let's keep working on it, and let's try to find a way.
Thank you, Tony. Nita.
Sure, thank you. I'm going to have to defer a little bit of intervention in Africa. In the Middle East, yes, it doesn't work because the Middle East, people in the Middle East don't want intervention from the United States. But I remember the intervention of President Bush to Sierra Leone and Liberia. That one brought positive things. And we cannot say it doesn't work in Middle East, it's not going to work in Congo. I believe Congolese, all of us here, the first question everybody's asking the Congolese is, what is the international community is going to do? Because they want the international community to intervene. In Sierra Leone, in Liberia, I've seen President Bush is one of my favorite presidents just because of that. He told Charles Taylor, you have 2 days. 2 days to leave power or we're coming with the military. And he didn't even have the military. Charles Taylor left power. And today, Liberia, it's a peaceful place where the president has been elected twice and things are going right. In Cote d'Ivoire, we've seen it when Gbagbo trying to cling onto power. Friends say, we're coming. You have a couple days to leave. And today, Cote d'Ivoire is sort of kind of okay. We've seen the same thing in Yahya Jammeh not long ago. Yahya Jammeh lost the election, refused to leave. The African Union say, we do not going to take that. You have a couple days to leave or we're coming. They even sent the military. They didn't even shoot anybody. Yahya Jammeh left. That's the difference of intervention when things are not going right, when talks are not helping, when every possible chance to give to a president to leave power with all the money stole and leave and do other things and he refusing. We have no other options. I think intervention is exactly what the Congolese are asking here. No more talks. No more accord. We have to give him a benchmark. We have up to December 31st of 2017, you have shown you're able to organize the election. You organize the election, or we going to take you out. That's something that can make him think twice. Because right now, everything he does, it's okay. Oh, no, he did good for the 10 years. He built some roads, like give him some slack. We've been giving him slack. Nothing is going forward. People keep dying. We're having more violence. And he's has shown that he's going to use the violence to quiet the entire country and turn Congo to his private property. And we cannot let that arrive.
Thank you, Nita. Thank you. Very powerful. Dane, last one.
So on the MONUSCO reforms, two quick things. One is the Force Intervention Brigade that was approved in 2013 to be more offensive against various rebel groups. I think it's time to revisit that and reform that. And secondarily, I would say generally MINUSCO should be more agile, more mobile, and be deployed in smaller units. Most of MINUSCO is in the east in large bases in the Kivus. Now we're seeing unrest throughout the country, so it's time for MINUSCO to reform in that way. My final comment is we all are concerned about where things are going. And from my perspective, there's three big scenarios that could play out. One is that some way, somehow, free and fair elections unfold. And maybe they're slightly delayed, but it's some sort of replication of what happened in 2005. Elections were scheduled in 2005, but they happened in 2006, broadly in a fair and free way. The second scenario is business as usual. So nothing happens this year, there's some other agreement, and something gets pushed on, and we just continue like this for in perpetuity. The third scenario is that because of all the complexity of going on and the multitude of pressures economically, socially, security-wise, politically, we have mass chaos and some sort of implosion of the state overall. All of us, as we've talked about, of options today in terms of engaging on budgets, engaging agents on people, in terms of engaging on the international pressure, international community, we all can do something. So let's try.
Listen, thank you all for being here and the excellent questions and expertise and passion that you've brought to this. And please join me in thanking the panel as well.